Well, the subject then is creation versus evolution. And you can see that really it's a choice between one or the other. Either creation is true or evolution is true. They are at opposite ends of the spectrum of possibility. You can't really have a form of both or some merging of the two. Either we were created, as we've just read in the Bible, everything in 6 days from the beginning to the end, and everything ready at an appropriate time in one of the 6 days, or life evolved over millions or billions of years, you know, gradually starting to form more complex things. You can't have either it's one or the other. They're both two extremes. First of all, I want to define what evolution is. People would generally say, well, evolution is the scientific theory of how life on Earth originated. I'd like to debunk that right from the start, because evolution isn't scientific and it isn't even a theory. The reason I'm saying that is because if you think about what does science mean, when is something scientific and when is something not scientific? Well, if you just look on an encyclopedia or how scientists define themselves and how scientists would separate themselves from something that isn't science, science, or the scientific method, is something that by definition is provable. You can actually prove something. And through a long sequence of experiments, scientists have, in certain fields like physics or chemistry, have established certain things that are demonstrated by experiments. And to advance knowledge, you need a control experiment. You need something which is taken, and to prove the theory, you need something. For example, if you think of medicine, you have, and you want to test a new drug scientifically, then you need to have a control drug, something like a placebo or a white pill that doesn't actually do a lot. And there's another white pill that's the medicine that you're trying to test, and you have a control experiment, and you have, you know, another group of people taking the pill. You'd also have a blind trial where the people taking the medicine or whatever don't know whether they're taking the real thing or not. The scientific method says that you'd also have double blind trials, meaning that the scientists themselves don't even know who's taking, you know, what part of the experiment, otherwise they might start to influence things. And importantly, once you've done a scientific experiment or using a scientific method, that would then be published in a paper, a journal of some kind. It would then be peer reviewed. In other words, lots of other scientists would review that paper. And importantly, that experiment would then be capable of being reproduced. Any scientist anywhere in the whole world would know enough to be able to reproduce your experiment. And 100% of the time, they should find exactly the same thing. And that's how you build on a bank of experiments. And all the true science, like physics for example, is built on a whole bank of experiments that have been conducted over time, and everyone learning physics in university will know all the basic experiments that have been done to prove what is now established as fact in physics. Chemistry also has a whole bunch of experiments. In school you'll do all those experiments and prove that all about molecules, etc. Well, the problem is, in evolution, there's none of that stuff. Physicists actually laugh out loud when they speak to evolutionists, because physicists are scientists. They have a whole bunch of experiments, etc., which prove things. But in evolution, there's nothing like that. There are, by definition, no possibility of having a scientific method. You can't, like, have one species that's evolving over 10 million years and another species that isn't evolving to prove whether evolution is correct. You can't come up with a theory of evolution where you make life evolve in one direction and have a control experiment where life doesn't evolve in that direction, thus coming up with a theory that you can prove how things evolved. It's impossible. You can't have an experiment at all. You obviously can't have a blind trial or a double blind trial, because you can't have an experiment where something evolves over millions of years. Therefore, there are no experiments in evolution. There's no way of having a bank of experiments that people can prove how that life did evolve. Therefore, by definition, by scientists' own definition, evolution is not scientific. It doesn't follow the scientific method. It can, by definition, never follow the scientific method, because you can't have experiments, you can't have control experiments. You can't test it, you can't try it, you can't attempt to do all those things. And therefore, really, strictly speaking, evolution isn't even a theory either. Because a theory is something which you can put to the test. A theory is either true or it's not true. And you put a theory to the test, you devise some experiment to prove whether it's right or wrong, and if it's wrong, that theory then gets debunked and you come up with another theory to test, and if it's right, you then establish that in your bank of experiments. So unfortunately, evolution isn't a science. It doesn't follow the scientific method at all. It's incapable of ever being tested or tried out in some way, and it's not even a theory, because you can't try it out. Therefore, evolution, sadly, isn't a scientific theory. It's not scientific and it's not theory. It can't be tested in any way, shape or form. So what is evolution? Well, evolution is, at best, it's a kind of philosophical outlook on how life in general improves over time, and therefore maybe we can say that life is getting better generally. And that's really the whole philosophy that evolution is based on. At worst, really, it's a dogmatic religious belief. People just believe evolution, regardless of what evidence is thrown at them to suggest the alternative. So evolution is not scientific and it's not a theory. It's not capable of ever being tested in any scientific way. Creation, on the other hand, first of all, there's many, many things that suggest creation is true. And by creation, we mean the biblical idea of creation. That is, there was nothing, and then life as we know it was created quickly over a sequence of days, and suddenly over a sequence of days to get what we have now. So scientists, or so-called scientists, having evolutionary ideas over many, many years now, decades, have come up with ideas or theories of how evolution could have evolved. It might have been this way, it might have been that way, maybe it was some other way. But every single one of those theories, and strictly speaking they're not theories because you can't prove them, but the idea that that's a possibility has been comprehensively disproved by other scientists, usually ones who have their own theories how it might have happened. So evolutionary theory after theory has been debunked comprehensively by scientists, and that itself disproves evolution. But all the evidence, this is actual things that prove something, over and over again prove that creation is the only explanation of how life evolved, how life was formed here. Everything in nature, just every single thing you look at, is easily explained by creation. It becomes common sense that things were created in the way that they were, and that the opposite of that would be evolution, where there's, you know, millions or billions of years and tiny little steps where things start to slowly change over time, but an undirected process without a creator. And over again, everything in creation proves that is completely impossible. Therefore, all the evidence is that life was designed by a designer, by an all-powerful, all-intelligent God. And the world around us is just full of evidence of that. Let me just give you one example to show what we're trying to demonstrate here. For example, if you saw that watch in an antique shop or attached to somebody's clothing or whatever, would you say the watch was designed by a creator, by somebody who made it? Or could you say that it was some sort of massive explosion and millions of years later that watch kind of happened to look like it does now? Well, if you just were honest with yourself, I think common sense would tell you that it was designed. It shows all the evidence of the hallmarks of being designed. It's got a purpose, it's got a function, it's got a way of attaching it to your clothing. It's got several ways so that it doesn't get damaged. There's a glass face over the hands, there's a cover over the whole thing, and the whole little mechanism of how it works internally tells the time, and it keeps time. So it's obvious that it's been designed, really. And yet, you could kind of come up with a clever, inverted commas, clever bunch of arguments as to kind of show that it hasn't really been designed, maybe it just happened that way and one thing fell into place and then something else maybe fell on top. All those arguments would just be silly sort of theories, really. Common sense tells you it's been designed. However, over and over again in nature, we see exactly that sort of thing, where common sense is obvious that something has been designed the way it is. and you've really got to dig down deep into your psyche to try and come up with some weird way of how this could ever have evolved through random chance, through millions of little changes over time. Common sense, over and over again, as we'll see in nature, tells you that things are designed to work right from the word go, and that any convoluted theories as to how it evolved over time are just evading common sense, really. There are thousands of examples, way more complex than just a watch, in nature, and yet so-called scientists deny the possibility that they just might have been designed on purpose by an all-intelligent creator. So let's look at some of the examples that I'll look at during this talk. Actual evidence that demonstrate creation is, for example, the idea of irreducible complexity, that there is a point at which things can't evolve slowly over millions and millions of little steps. They just have to be there right from the start, in the way that they are, because the whole thing doesn't work otherwise. There's lots of meaningful patterns in nature, as we'll see. Nature itself and our universe is fine-tuned, it's designed to work, and it's designed to support life. There's lots of examples where a creature has to be intelligent, in other words, has to think of lots of different ways in which life can support itself and flourish for thousands of years. Also, co-dependence of species, where species are depend on each other, and things can't happen if both those species and, in fact, everything else is there right from the word go. Over and over again, creation is the obvious explanation. It's just staring you in the face that must be the correct way. And evolution becomes more and more contorted and, you know, weird as you start to see these examples. So everything converges on biblical creation. In other words, creation as described in the pages of Scripture as being the only explanation we can see in nature around us. But let's first of all think about the idea of irreducible complexity. Lots and lots of systems are composed of little parts, but if you take away just one little part, then the whole thing doesn't work. In a very crude sense, you could think about a hand grenade. A hand grenade is a device that's meant to explode. To stop it exploding, you put a pin, and you take the pin out, waits 10 seconds or whatever, and then it explodes. But if you take away all those different parts, if you don't have a pin, it'll just explode in the box. If you don't have gunpowder, it'll just not work at all. You have to have all of those parts together working at the same time in order for it to work. And lots and lots and lots of things in nature are like that. So a system of irreducible complexity is composed of several well-matched, interacting parts that contribute to the overall function. And if you remove just any one of those parts, then the system as a whole just doesn't work. In other words, that is not something which can change and evolve or become better and, you know, billions of years later it then becomes whole. Darwin himself, in The Origin of Species, actually recognised this fact. He said he was looking at the eye, because in The Origin of Species he wasn't entirely convinced of evolution himself. He was throwing out kind of thoughts to try and see what other scientists thought of them. And he fully expected to be challenged, except unfortunately people didn't challenge him. They simply swallowed the whole theory without any more thought. But in The Origin of Species, Darwin says, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down." So Darwin says, if there ever was an organ that couldn't possibly have evolved over millions of years with slight changes every time, evolution just isn't a possibility. And he actually goes on to say that the human eye, is one example of such a thing. He says the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances, makes him shudder. In other words, he looks at the human eye and actually shudders because his whole theory falls apart. That's several ideas that people ignore in The Origin of Species. So Darwin was saying that something with irreducible complexity needs a designer. Think back to the watch example. You know, if you take out one part, the whole thing doesn't work. If you take out the mechanism or the hands or protection mechanisms or anything else, the whole thing doesn't work. It can't evolve over successive changes. Nature, as it happens, is absolutely jam-packed full of irreducible complexity. an obvious design. Everywhere you turn, this whole talk could be nothing other than showing examples of irreducible complexity. Remember that in science, to prove a theory, it's extremely hard because you're trying to prove that every single possibility must be true. But to disprove something, you only have to give one example where it doesn't work and the whole theory is then untrue. So you really only have to give one example where something could not possibly have evolved through a sequence of small changes, and automatically that whole thing becomes untrue. So in the case of lots of bacteria, you see pictures under the microscope of little bacteria kind of floating through water, etc. And they've got little, what look like whiskers or hairs that spin round and round, and that's what drives them forward. But if you actually look at something just as simple as that mechanism, it's every bit as complex as a sort of gearing mechanism that you might have in an engine. Those little filaments or hairs spin round and round and round. They never wear out. You don't get, 10,000 revolutions, then they rust and stop working or fall off, or they don't fly off if they go too fast or anything like that. But in every cell where there's something that drives the cell forward in fluid, you have a mechanism exactly like that. They've got a filament that spins round, that could be a protein chain or something like that. They've got some sort of bent round hook so that they can go outwards. They've got an outer membrane or shield to stop water, etc. getting in. They've got some sort of bearing that allows them to turn round and not wear out. They've got some sort of inner layer, and then they've got some sort of rotor, and obviously they need power. Something has to drive that round and round. So a little tiny cell that you can hardly see would need power, something that generates power, mitochondria it's called, and other little things to tell them which direction they're heading. But if you take away any one of those parts, it's phenomenally complex. If this was a car engine, you'd have a big 500-page book explaining how it all worked, and yet people think this just suddenly evolved out of a big bang or something. Take another example. Nature is literally full of them. That something like a Venus flytrap. We had one on the windowsill recently. But basically, the Venus flytrap is designed. It's lots of little parts that together, for example, it's got these big open cup things with pincers almost. And if a fly goes into those, it closes up and then starts to digest the fly. But they've got a smell that attracts flies. It smells of rotting meat, even though there is no meat. The plant knows how to produce smells that make the fly think there's rotting meat there. It's got things that attract the fly into it. It's then got a sort of prison mechanism that suddenly closes on the fly. It's then got digestive fluid that digests it. And unlike every other plant that absorbs nutrients from the soil, the Venus flytrap gets its energy from, actual flies, etc. So there's a whole handful of mechanisms that have to be there together. If you don't have that sudden mechanism that can jam shut in the fly, and we all know how quick flies can be if you're trying to capture them, then the whole thing won't work. If you don't have those prongs that hold it in like a prism, it won't work. If you don't have the smell that attracts the fly in the first place, it won't work. If you don't have the spring mechanism, if you don't have the digestive fluid, everything needs to be there right from the word go. And there's loads more examples. Here's another quick one. The Bombardier beetle. It produces a whole bunch of a big explosion out its abdomen, and it literally is an explosion that allows it to kind of jump out of the way when danger is happening. But if you look at how that's designed, there's actually two types of chemicals that, when mixed, produce an explosion. And normally inside the beetle's body, they're shielded from each other. But they get expelled out just at the time the beetle wants to jump out the way or scare away predators, except that you can't just combine them at the same time, otherwise the beetle will blow up. Instead, you've got to inject another chemical that neutralizes those two chemicals together, and just at the mechanism or the time at which those fluids get ejected out the beetle's abdomen, another chemical comes along which kind of unneutralizes those chemicals. In other words, makes them explode. And all of that, the jet propulsion mechanism, the compressor to get them in together, the two chemicals not exploding inside the beetle's body, all of those little mechanisms need to be there at the same time. In fact, people have taken slow motion pictures of what actually happened, And whereas it looks like there's a massive explosion and the beetle jumps, you know, several inches away, it turns out there's actually a whole sequence of tiny little explosions. If there was one big explosion, the beetle would blow up. Instead, there needs to be a sequence of little tiny explosions which together bounce the beetle away or scare away predators. Otherwise, the whole beetle would just blow up. But all of that has to be there in full right from the very beginning. Any one of those parts taken away and the thing won't work. And nature is just jam-packed full of examples like that. For example, a spider's web has things like a bridge thread. It's got an anchor thread to tie it to different trees. It's got a spiral where, and, you know, radial things to make the, you know, so in the wind this web doesn't get destroyed. There's a little spider sitting in the middle of that, but it doesn't get caught in its own web. Flies get caught in the web, but the spider itself doesn't get caught in its own web. How does it do that? Well, it turns out it's got little runners, and there's oil produced in the sort of grooves of the runners, and it slides down its own web in such a way that it doesn't get caught. The web actually has different types and strengths of silk. Some are sticky and some aren't. But right from the beginning, as soon as a little spiderling hatches out of its egg, it already knows how to crawl away and start making webs everywhere. Spiders can't exactly see when they see a gate post or something and make a web between the posts of the gate. Somehow they know where to attach stuff. And right from the beginning, the mother spider doesn't teach its young how to make a web. All of that is there right from the beginning. The spider's programmed into it how to do that. It knows how to make the web structurally strong so that, you know, leaves won't knock it over or wind won't knock it over. A big fly like a crane fly won't rip the web up. And yet the spider knows where exactly a fly has landed in its web. But all of that has to be there right from the very beginning in order to, otherwise the whole thing just simply won't work. A couple more examples is the whole idea of a cell. This book on the right hand side, Essential Cell Biology, and that's essential cell biology. In other words, the basics of just basically how a cell works, you know, in the round. There's a book you can buy from Amazon, which is 900 pages long, all about how just one tiny little cell that you can hardly even see how it works. And again, this is just the essential. There's another book that was something like 1,400 pages, again, on cell biology. You can go further and get, you know, genetics, how a cell, how genetics works. And again, that's another 1,000 or 2,000 page book. But a cell, just one tiny little cell, is so complex that every single part has to be there right from the word go. It needs a cell wall to keep the cell intact, for example. A cell needs some method of producing power, otherwise all the chemical functions in the cell won't work. A cell needs to know how to reproduce, how to divide, how to split up and form other cells. It needs to know how to repair itself. You know, when a cell gets damaged, it's got a mechanism that automatically repairs itself. Just imagine how fantastic it would be, us humans, could invent a machine that actually could fix itself when it went wrong. If you crashed your car, and the car just automatically knew how to fix itself, where to get plastic and metal and things like that from. If the car just managed to fuel itself automatically, if it simply knew where in the environment to create petrol from. If you decided you'd like another car, thank you very much, wouldn't it be great if the car could just divide and all of a sudden you've got two cars? You know, there's no possibility ever of humans inventing something as advanced and complicated as that. Something which can absorb what it needs from the environment. And yet a cell, that you can hardly see nowadays, is exactly that. It's got a nucleus or a brain that tells it what to do. A cell is like a whole living factory, a whole living city. It's got thousands of little parts that all interact together. And everything has to be there all at once. It just can't evolve and build itself up steadily over millions or billions of years. You know, that book is 1,000 pages thick, and just the generality of how a cell works, that's how complex it is. Or the human body. Darwin said that he would shudder just thinking about something as simple as an eye, how an eye could possibly have been formed by lots of random little small changes. And yet the human body is full of things like that. The way the heart works with chambers, kidneys, liver, lungs, how we've got different systems that together make up the whole person. We've got a skin system that protects you from germs and things coming out from the outside. You've got a cardiovascular system, heart and lungs that pump blood around your body and absorb air from the atmosphere. You've got a circulation system that over and over again for 90 odd years, your heart just pumps and pumps and pumps blood around. You've got an autoimmune system that actually fights invaders coming into your body, methods of defending your body against invaders and actually attacking them if they do get in. We have a central nervous system to tell us, you know, when you're touching something, if you're hot, if you're cold, if there's chemicals around, if you're hungry. We've got a system that tells you how to do that. We've got a system that you just open your mouth, shove in some food, and it just digests it somehow. And yet, we also have a waste system that gets rid of anything your body can't use. We've got a reproductive system that allows new human beings and new animals to be created, as if by magic. We've got a structural, a skeleton system. After all, if you simply had a plastic bag or something with all this stuff inside it, it wouldn't work. You have to have a skeleton, something that keeps you upright and stops you from just collapsing like a pile of jelly on the floor. The human body is inherently irreducible complexity. If you take away any one of these parts, the human just dies instantly. Take away the blood and you die. Take away the lungs, you die. Take away the heart, the lungs. Any part of this gets taken away, you die. HIV, for example, is where the body can't defend itself from attack anymore, and you die. You just die from it. If you didn't have eyes or ears, you wouldn't be able to survive anymore. If you weren't able to get rid of the waste that you from the food that you eat, again, you would die. This can't evolve over millions of years. It can't be lots of little changes systematically building up over time. So irreducible complexity in nature, just everything you see around you in nature is inherently complexity that can't be reduced any further. It can't happen over millions of years through small steps happening. Let's look at another angle of thinking through meaningful patterns. So a pattern is something that shows some evidence of not being random. It's something which has meaning. So a meaningful pattern is one that's unlikely to ever occur purely by chance. And it's impossible for something that's a meaningful pattern that can't exist in things that are formed by unguided process, in other words, by evolution, or just random changes over time. So if you can find meaningful patterns in nature, that shows that living things did not get there just by chance alone. Something must have guided them to make that pattern or form that pattern. And again, that's indicating that there's an intelligence and therefore a creator. So let's look at some examples. Just common sense, for example, if you went down to the beach and you saw a pattern like this, which says Jim and Kathy Fernan, July the 28th, 2007, and then wedding bells. That's an obvious example of a meaningful pattern. Maybe you could come up with some explanation where there was thousands of little shells got washed up in the beach and the sea battered them to and fro, and maybe there was a limpet or something that crawled along the sand and just happened to make this pattern. But really, common sense tells you that someone wrote this. It's got a meaning, it's a wedding of some kind. Maybe it was one of them, maybe it was the guests at the wedding, but someone went down to the beach and wrote this. And common sense tells you there's a meaning there, it's a pattern. Except that in nature, over and over again, we see that same meaningful patterns happening again and again. For example, DNA is like a blueprint, a sequence of instructions that tells a single cell how to reproduce the entire living body. So for example, the DNA of a zebra tells it as a sequence of tiny little steps over, you know, very, very fast, it happens quite fast, a period of months, but one little DNA strand are all the instructions a tiny little cell needs to reproduce itself and turn itself into an entire zebra. So, and same thing with a horse, a cat, a dog, a human, everything's got different DNA, but it's like a whole sequence of instructions that step by step, you know, literally molecule by molecule, cell by cell, protein by protein, tells the thing, the living creature, how to reproduce itself and form another living creature, exactly the same as the first one. So all of that is tremendously complex. You can buy, you know, a 2,000-page book on how it all works. and there's still lots of things unexplained, but that's meaningful information. It's not just random stuff. It's a meaningful pattern. That did not happen by random chance. It can only happen by somebody systematically sitting down, a creator, and actually planning out what would be needed to reproduce one cell, how you would get all those different instructions that can explain to the cell how to reproduce itself. That's a meaningful pattern. You can't create it all by chance alone. Here's more meaningful patterns. These are pretty beautiful colours. If life evolved randomly through a sequence of random things, you'd get every colour under the sun there. Browns and blacks and muddy colours and everything washed out in grey and random colours like pretty colours with horrible colours. But in nature, over and over again, for absolutely no reason whatsoever, there is beauty and elegance there. That's a meaningful pattern that's been put there by a designer. For example, fish under the water, beyond about 5 or 10 metres, you can't even see colour. So there's no reason for them to evolve colour, because they can't see colour. And yet fish, quite deep down, with beautiful colours and patterns that the fish can't even see. Plants, obviously can't, they've got no eyes, so they don't know what colour they are. Insects, for the most part, are colourblind. They don't see colours like we do. So there's absolutely no reason in the world why this would ever have evolved through chance. Fish, you know, coral, all these beautiful patterns serve no purpose other than just simply beauty. It's a pattern that means something. It's designed to create a life that's enjoyable to live. Here are some more examples of patterns that mean something. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of examples in nature where two animals, or possibly more than two, have patterns on them that are really, really similar. In fact, they're so similar that it can be quite difficult to tell them apart. So difficult, in fact, that animals won't be able to tell them apart. But humans, if you have the right knowledge, you will. So, for example, there's a very poisonous snake called the coral snake. And there's another snake called the false coral snake. And unless you actually almost do a spot the difference competition, you won't know the difference between them. I think the coral snake has a rhyme about it, red and yellow, kill a fellow. Red and black, nice to Jack. So if the pattern is red, yellow, black, that's a real one, stay away from it. But if it's red, black, yellow, then it's okay, it's a false one. No matter how similar they act and everything else, it's not the real one. Now, why would a pattern like that ever have been so similar over two species? The snake can't see, it can't copy its neighbour, it can't think to itself, ooh, everyone's staying away from the coral snake. Why don't I evolve a sequence of stripes that look just like it? Because it can't change its own DNA. If you could change your DNA, it'd be fantastic. I would be 6 foot tall, blonde, like a Viking, handsome, etc. You can't change your DNA just because you would like to look like something else. And there's lots of examples in nature of that. A wasp is a poisonous little thing, but there's a hoverfly that when people see it, they think it looks like a wasp, but it's not. It flies slightly differently, etc. Or there's cow parsley, which is edible, and there's fool's parsley, which isn't. And they are incredibly similar. You've really got to have a spot the difference book to know the difference. We have, in this country, sweet violet, which is edible. It's a flower that you can eat. But dog violet is really similar. Slightly different pattern, slightly different colour from the leaves, and the leaves are slightly different shape. But just from casual looking, you wouldn't know the difference. There's sweet chestnut, which you can eat, and there's horse chestnut, which you can't. But they all look very, very similar. So there's lots of things in nature that are really similar. It's a pattern that's been put there by a designer. It's almost as if God is kind of having a little joke, having two things that are really similar, but only when you look really closely, you see the difference. Animals won't have intelligence or the knowledge or the books to read that they can find the differences between these things. But it allows certain things to show that there's patterns there. It's wonderful how it all works. So there's irreducible complexity in nature. There is meaningful patterns. But here's a completely different way of thinking about creation versus evolution. We have a fine-tuned universe. Everything in this universe, meaning the solar system, the stars, etc., the moon, the planets, everything on Earth is designed to provide the very conditions that allow life to exist on Earth. And the constants, the physical things that allows life to exist, are actually in a very, very narrow range. If you take away any one of them, life ceases to exist, you know, very, very quickly. In other words, if things were just slightly different, life on Earth would cease. And it's not like there's millions of planets out there all exactly the same. As far as we know, we really are unique in this whole solar system. So for example, we know that there are, you know, a number of different planets, 9 or 10, depending on how you define a planet, all in a row, well, circulating the Sun. But it turns out there's lots of reasons for thinking that the Earth is just exactly right for life. For example, something has to be the right shape. If we had a planet that was square or oblong or flat or something, it would just spin off and it wouldn't be stable. A planet needs to be roundish in order to actually be stable and not just flip off somewhere. It has to be the right shape. The balance of oxygen has to be right. It has to be within quite narrow ranges. If you have too much oxygen, oxygen becomes poisonous and you'll die if you breathe too much oxygen, but not enough, and you won't have enough to live. A planet has to be exactly the right size. If it's too small, the gravity won't be enough to hold the atmosphere, and like the Moon, the atmosphere will just sort of drift off. A planet needs to be big enough to hold an atmosphere, but it can't be too big, otherwise gravity would mean you wouldn't be able to move. There's lots of dangerous elements. If you look at the periodic table of elements, plutonium and arsenic and stuff like that, and then Earth, those all happen to be locked down within rocks under the Earth's surface where they can't hurt us. We don't find the good stuff that we need, such as carbon, deep down in the poisonous stuff on the surface. God has designed stuff so that all the poisonous stuff is where it can't hurt us. So there are no dangerous elements. And the Earth needs to be the right distance away from the Sun. If it's too far away, it gets too cold. If it's too close, it gets too hot. And you also need something which rotates in order to have seasons. Without seasons, things will never really change. Things will always be the same. Things won't be recycled properly. Strangely enough, you also need a moon, preferably one moon. But the moon needs to be a certain size. Without a moon, life on Earth will cease. The reason for that is because the moon has its own gravitational pull, and it provides tides that just wash, essentially lift all the water, bring it back and forward, and that effectively washes the sea out. All the rubbish gets turfed up onto the beach, and all the good water gets recycled round and round. If that wasn't the case, if we didn't have a moon, and if the moon wasn't round, and if it wasn't the right shape, life or seawater, for example, would just become stagnant. It would be like a huge pond. A planet is needed, and a planet needs to have a moon in order to survive. But all of that has to be there right from the word go, otherwise life ceases to exist. So let's look on at another example. Everything in nature tells us that there is an intelligent designer, intelligent creator, who has actually systematically thought of everything that we need. What would be needed? You can't just create life, you have to make life sustainable for thousands of years going into the future. That means, for example, that you have to have a cycle of life where things get recycled if they die. You need the sun to provide energy and sustainable energy for plants and then plants to animals, etc. You have to have a food chain in order for every single thing, right from the very beginning, right to the very top, everything needs to have something to eat it, and in turn something to eat. So there's a food chain, and there's lots of dependencies between those. If you just think for a few moments about how life on Earth actually exists, every single aspect of life on Earth has been carefully thought out. It's not enough just for random chance to produce a random species, because if that did happen, that random species would die out. You have to have reproduction. Life, in other words, needs to produce new life. Otherwise, if there was such a thing as something which had evolved by itself, it would die because, you know, 10 billion years later it would have to find a mate. It would be dead by then. Secondly, you have to have recycling. When an animal dies, it needs to be recycled away somehow. In other words, it needs to be disposed of. We throw things into landfill sites, but in nature, when something dies, bit by bit, it gets recycled. For example, things will go mouldy. The mould will break it down, or other animals like crows, etc., will eat an animal if it dies, or failing all that, flies will put eggs in it and the maggots will eat away the flesh, the worms eventually pull things under the ground. So there's a whole sequence of mechanisms in place that actually recycle. You know, if leaves fall off a tree and fall to the ground, they get recycled, they rot away, you know, mushrooms and fungus eat them away, or they get pulled under the ground, or they disintegrate. If a big animal like a horse dies, it doesn't just sit there for a million years. Gradually it will get eaten, then it gets broken down further by flies, then mold will take over, and finally the worms will pull it under the surface of the earth for that energy to be recycled. Populations are a constant balancing act. Everything eats something, and everything has something which eats it. For example, if there's too many green fly one year, then ladybirds will eat the green fly. And if there's too many green fly, the birds will eat the ladybirds. And if there's too many little birds eating the ladybirds, then the big birds, like hawks, will eat them. And if there's too many hawks, there won't be enough to feed them, and so they'll die. So everything in nature is constant population balancing, make sure that everything is in control. If you take away any single part of that, life ceases to exist really quickly. Flies would take over, or mold would take over. Everything would rot and decay, but everything wouldn't rot and decay. We have insects to pollinate flowers. Take away the insects, flowers die. Take away flowers, the insects die. We have things like bats pollinating bananas. We have seeds that are designed to be carried in animal fur, the things like sticky bits that attach them onto the fur, or animals eat seeds, and then they have droppings which contain not only the seed ready to always be planted in the earth, but some fertilizer as well. We have bacteria, flies, and worms constantly doing a job of recycling things. Now all of that together isn't just chance. It didn't just happen over billions of years, bit by bit. It shows careful design. It shows somebody who's systematically thought out what would be required to not only create life in 6 days, but to sustain it over thousands of years more. So there's a constant balancing act and everything is kept in control. There's animals and plants designed to fill every single niche, to make sure that nothing is left unexploited. So for example, Darwin looked at finches and he also looked at tortoises. He saw the different ways that the beaks of finches could do different things. Some were big, big beaks that could crack open things like nuts. Some were very delicate beaks that could go inside little pine cones and things and extract a really delicate seed. And he looked at how tortoises had different types of necks that allowed them to reach different plants, etc., and behave in different ways. Now, far from evolving over billions of years, because if it took billions of years, all the seeds, the nuts, etc., wouldn't be reproduced. That shows clear evidence of design. God has designed it so that everything is a niche, everything has something it feeds on, and something in turn feeds on it. If everything was the same, life would cease to exist because there would be no variety and something would get left out of the food chain. And there are lots and lots of examples of this. Another example is symbiosis, or species being codependent. Everything in nature, there's hundreds of examples of species being dependent on something else other than themselves. In other words, they could not have evolved steadily over millions of years because they need something else which is alive at the same time, fully formed. And there's lots of examples in nature. For example, there's a very poisonous plant which we have in Britain called ragwort. It's so poisonous, in fact, that if it gets in a field with wheat or something, and the farmer comes along and takes it all, if the animals, like cows, eat that wheat, they can actually die. It contains alkaloid poisons which are very toxic. There's only one animal in the world that can ever eat that, and it's a cinnabar moth. There's a little stripy red and yellow, black and yellow caterpillar, which is designed so it can eat that ragwort plant. That's all it eats, just ragwort. It takes the poisons, it locks it away in its body when it's a caterpillar, doesn't kill it, and when it's a moth, or when it turns into a moth, those poisons again get released into its body. It doesn't hurt the caterpillar or the moth, but if a bird or something eats it, the bird can die. So the moth needs the ragwort needs the moth. There's we all know crocodiles, for example. is a little bird called a crocodile bird that not only warns the crocodile that there's danger approaching through little tweeting noises, but when the crocodile's jaws are open, this little bird actually hops inside the crocodile's mouth. You'd think it'd be really dangerous, but it starts picking up bits of meat and parasites and things like that from the crocodile's mouth. And if the bird didn't do that, the crocodile would eventually get, you know, toothache or tooth poisoning and things like that, probably get attacked by something. So the bird needs the crocodile to get all this food from its mouth, but the crocodile needs the bird. There's also other examples of that in nature, where there's birds called egrets, and they eat the parasites from large mammals like rhinoceros, elephants and things like that. So an elephant can't scratch his back, it can't reach back to get parasites off like ticks, but the birds can. And so these big birds hop along the backs of these big animals and they feed off the ticks, etc., on the backs of them. So they need each other, they can't survive without each other. There's a badger called a honey badger, and there's a type of bird called a honey guide bird. And the bird can't break open an ant's nest, but the badger can. But the badger can't just go around all the time looking for nests, but the bird can, because it flies around and can see them very quickly. So this bird actually guides honey badgers to an ant's nest. The badger then, not an ant's nest, sorry, a wasp nest, or a bee's nest. The honey badger's got big strong claws and it can rip open the nest. The bird then gets the honey that it wants, and it can also eat all the bees, etc. And the badger gets the honey that it wants, so they're dependent on each other. Ants, for example, seem strange, but ants actually farm mushrooms in Egypt. And ants, deep down in the ant nest, they've got little mushroom farms where they grow fungus, like they become little farmers, mushroom farmers. But they also capture, they farm aphids. They take the aphids into their little ant nests, and they feed off them. So, you know, ants do all that stuff. They actually need other species to survive. And there are thousands of examples in nature where one or more or two species all need each other to survive at the same time. So you've looked at lots and lots of examples in nature that demonstrate that life was created, it was thought about, it was planned, it was systematic, and it was all there right from the beginning in a sequence of days. It could not have taken place over millions of years or billions of years or whatever figure you want to put. These are all things that can't, you know, by definition, they can't happen systematically with slow changes every time. They're either all there right from the word go, or they're not there, and they can't happen slowly. They must be there from the beginning, right from the word go. So in Genesis chapter 1, we've read that in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. It then goes on to explain how over a sequence of days, God systematically created certain animals in a certain order. Plants first, then things that feed off plants, then animals, and finally man. They were created, they were all together created as they were, everything after its own kind. Things don't change into different kinds. A horse doesn't give birth to a monkey, and monkeys don't give birth to whales. Things can't change. You know, slugs don't change into fish, and the fish don't decide that they're going to grow legs and climb out onto land. And if they were to climb out onto land, they don't grow fur and climb trees and become monkeys. That's just silliness. That can't happen. Everything in nature is designed according to its kind. There's a verse in Proverbs, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." When you start to look at nature around you, this is the beginning of knowledge, it's the beginning of understanding that there is a creator that's designed all these things on purpose. But fools, people who are just silly, mentally like children, despise that idea. They despise wisdom, they don't like being told what happened. And importantly, in Romans chapter 1, it says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen." In other words, just look at nature around you. Everything is obvious, that things have been created. They're clearly seen. There's clear evidence of the Creator being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. In other words, God created all this for his own, because he was able to, so that everyone is without excuse. Because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. Neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And that describes people who believe in evolution in a nutshell. They see all these wonderful things in nature about them. They devise some weird, convoluted explanation of how that must have taken place over millions of years. No matter how much that defies common sense, that's what they think. They become vain in their own imaginations, letting their imaginations create some weird and wonderful tale of how it evolved. And their heart becomes darkened. And they claim that they're wise, that they're science, and that evolution is a scientific theory, and that people who believe in the Bible are fools. In fact, it's the other way around. People who believe in creation are the wise ones. They understand that there's a God in heaven ruling over. And evolutionary, hate to call them evolutionary scientists, but they are the ones who have become fools by denying nature and denying all the things, the evidence they see around them. It's those who have become fools, like children coming up with some explanation as to why something happened. And so, to conclude really, everything around us, every single facet of nature that you look at, is crying out for there to be an intelligent creator. It has to be biblical creation. It's the only explanation where over a sequence of days, life on earth as we now know it was formed. Man cannot come to terms with this. He prefers to clutch at straws rather than believe that there's a creator out there. And no matter how overwhelming the evidence is, no matter how many examples you give, you know, each one of these I could have given, spent all day giving example after example. You only need one example to disprove a theory, and all these examples disprove evolution. So overwhelming evidence that there's a creator. You know, what is so difficult about believing in a creator? It really isn't difficult. Well, the answer is because people, it's not so much the theory, they just don't want the idea of there being a creator. Because if there's a creator, that means there's consequences to that. There's a reason why we were created. God wants something from us. He wants responsibility from us. He doesn't want his nature, the nature that we see around us, to be, you know, destroyed by foolish people. Claim to be scientists. So the Bible is true. Creation is true. We were created for a purpose. God will shortly intervene. All the other answers that you could want. You know, why were we created? What's the purpose of man? What's God's plan and purpose for creating life as we know it? All the answers you can find in the pages of the scriptures. People only have to look at the scriptures to find the example, the answers to all of that. It's only fools who pretend not to believe in evolution, who come up with all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas as to why things took millions or billions of years. Over and over again, all the evidence points to biblical creation as the only common sense explanation as to how life got here.